You better hold on tight, Spider Monkey.
Hello, welcome to episode 11, question mark, of Women of the Lord, right? 11?
I think so. Yeah.
11 episodes. Wow, congratulations, guys.
Thank you. My brain farted.
Yeah, I thought you were going to keep going with that intro because I was like, I'm not equipped to introduce Sam Friend.
No, I got you.
I may like her, but I don't know enough about her.
Sam graduated from TCNJ in 2019. I remember meeting her because I was a freshman at our theater organization, and she was known as like the go-to person, like the Swiss Army knife of theater. And I'm sure that's still how she's described in every other industry she enters into. But we're very happy to have her here today because this week's episode is all about Twilight, Harry Potter, and how cults, films, and franchises essentially shape generations.
I have never felt more equipped to talk about a topic. I have been obsessed with Harry Potter and Twilight since their inception. I'm so excited.
Do you genuinely like Twilight, or is that like a, it's so bad, it's good? Because that's where I'm at with Twilight.
Mm. Okay, so Twilight for me is one of those things that I started off hating.
Okay.
Because I was a fifth grader who hated myself.
Retweet.
And I slowly grew into like a high schooler who didn't hate myself. So where I'm at with Twilight is like, Twilight is a genuinely, genuinely good book series that has a lot of issues. And I am very critical of those issues because I love Twilight so much.
I have seen reports of people who do argue for it is written really well. And in that case, it's okay to say that objectively it's good, which is an argument I disagreed with when I was in fifth grade, because I remember reading it and saying, this is the most poorly written thing I've ever read. And then I read it again in high school and I was like, oh, my fifth grade self was absolutely right. This is trash.
I mean, I read it when I was young, but I remember really liking the book at the time. And actually what ended up making me hate the entire series was the first movie. Easily, truly watched that, went back, and then realized how horrible the series might have actually been.
Mm.
But I mean, if we're gonna be talking about Twilight and Harry Potter, the funny thing is like some people had that experience with Harry Potter, arguably, and had Twilight as their like fan thing, you know?
Yeah.
Which I find very interesting because they're not at all similar. But I would argue that their fan bases are equally as like incensed by them. I don't know why I just said incest.
I mean, it did feel that way at times. I remember being 11 or 12. I don't know if Sam has a similar experience, but I had a fan Harry Potter Instagram account. And I remember at the peak of 2011, 2012, there was all this like Instagram brouhaha over fighting over Twihards, like making fun of them, you know, justifying that Harry Potter was the morally right franchise to follow and things like that.
I did have a very similar experience. I think that Harry Potter and Twilight are very interesting because Harry Potter, not only did a lot of our generation grow up with Harry Potter, but they were also growing up with the internet at the time. So Harry Potter was one of those fandoms that really, really hit it big with the generation that was also hitting it big online. So a lot of those fandom fights were extremely amplified. Like, I'm sure had the internet been like as big as it was when Star Wars came out, everyone would have been fighting over like, does Harry belong with Hermione or does Ron belong with Hermione? Edward versus Jacob. And it would have been like a whole thing. But with Harry Potter, I don't know. I feel like a lot of people associate Harry Potter with their childhoods a lot more strongly than they do Twilight, and that makes it a lot harder to talk about objectively.
I'm really glad you brought up Star Wars, only because if, you know, you've read Twilight and Harry Potter, if you've even seen the movies, there's something about the fantastical and this idea of magic or the supernatural that really gets people going. Like, you have to assume that the interest in these things also must mean that there's something about the magical that allows people to assert their dominance in a way they can't in real life. But the funny thing about Harry Potter is that it may seem relatable because, like, you know how you guys have been saying, it's sort of a childhood thing. And I think for a lot of people, that brings a lot of like nostalgic and like relatable value in the fact that they're kids and you're a kid versus Twilight, where you might have read it in middle school and they were already in high school, but you felt a sense of either inferiority or superiority to the characters depending on when you read it and how you read it. Which, so I guess what I'm trying to say is like Harry Potter might have been easily powerful in the fact that you were seeing kids like break the norms. But I feel like Twilight might have instilled power in the fact that you might have read it and felt like better than the characters. Like you were like, oh, these people suck and they're bad, but I'm not, and I'm not stupid enough to like this in that way, which I think, or maybe I'm just talking for myself, but I feel like that in a way gives you a sense of control.
I think also the reason why we feel more morally righteous about Twilight is because we see so much of ourselves in Bella and the character's mistakes. And I say this only because it's so much easier to dislike characters that remind you of yourself because you don't want to see that on the page. And so I think, especially as both franchises affected the publishing industry in trends to come and for years. Like we can say this with Twilight, where the love triangles and the codependency, we see fans criticizing that more in YA novels. So maybe the morally righteous thing was good, had repercussions that were more positive than negative.
I also think it's a lot easier to feel morally like superior to a teenager than it is to a child. Like, It's so much easier to be like, oh my God, this chick is insane. What is she doing? Like, than it is to be like, oh, this child who is seeking love for the first time in his life is absolutely wrong in the way that he's going about seeking love.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just sort of thinking on Ambar's point too, because I don't think I ever found any relatability in Twilight in the way I did Harry Potter, but that might just be because the whiteness in Twilight is much more obvious in a way that it isn't in Harry Potter. Because I feel like in one of the stories, Harry Potter in a way sort of like, I hate to say it, but it's sort of like a post-racial utopia in which race is not real. But like, Twilight doesn't get that, especially with the idea of the vampire being this like literal, like glowing in the sunlight type figure. Hmm. In which like it would be very hard to imagine these pale people sitting in forks being dreary about their really, really typical problems. Because it's very rare to sort of see like, you know, BIPOC in those situations. Like, and you know, the movie tried. It like tried to put one black vampire in there and it was my worst nightmare. But I think there's something to be said about, right, these stories also being for the most part white narratives, and like how one maybe might have been more accessible than the other, but that might just be based on the content of that story rather than the actual like theoretical approach to it.
Yeah, culture was never something that the characters of Harry Potter really relied on. I mean, even with Dean Thomas, the sole black kid in his year, his whole deal was just soccer. And in Twilight, the reason the werewolves are so contentious is not only because they're Native Americans, but their magic is associated with their history and their ancestry. And that's not something vampires can access.
You know what it is too? Twilight is so American, it's almost off-putting. I think what Harry Potter so like, I guess makes people who have a certain racial or ethnic like denomination feel so comforted is that at least in a way it's global. Obviously England is not that global, but it feels a little farther away. It feels a little more cultured in a way than relying on just typical American things. And I know people can argue in the favor of Jacob, right, that he's Native American, that that's representation in a way, but again, it's a very American binary between there's Native Americans and there's white people and there's that whole issue. And I'm like, okay, yeah, I mean, great, there's that. But there has to be some conversation on like the actual makeup of America at some point.
Oh, absolutely. I think part of that, Sam, you were about to say something?
No, No, you say something first. I have a thought that's developing, and I need to let it finish.
She has the fetus of a thought. It's all good.
Oh, don't say fetus while we're talking about Twilight, please.
Renesmee, baby.
When was that we got to Renesmee? But on your thought of it being incredibly American, that has to do a lot with Stephenie Meyer being very Mormon, you know? We see this in Bella avoiding caffeine, marrying so young. And also the Bella's choice to have the baby, which is marketed as a choice, but it's still pro-life in that sense, you know?
It's very aggressively pro-life. I didn't know that Stephenie Meyer was a Mormon. That just rocked my world for a minute.
It just makes incredible amount of sense, especially because she had, power over the casting, and the director, Catherine Hardwicke, actually wanted to put more people of color in the vampire Cullen clan. And she went, no, that's not how I pictured them.
It does have a lot to do with, I think, the fact that it took place in Seattle. Mm. And this is something that we're like seeing a lot with like the Portland protests right now, is like Seattle is an aggressively white place, and like even the police brutality that's happening there is different than the police brutality that's happening everywhere else. But that said, all of the vampires across the land seem to have a single factor in common, and it's that they are not white. And that's really interesting. And it also, Twilight as a series sets up a lot of very stereotypical binaries. Like, it is the series itself, the conflict between the vampires and the werewolves is set up on this very stereotypical idea of like, these outsiders came into our land and they took what was ours, and so we changed to protect ourselves. And while that is like, that is the history of Native Americans in America, is people coming and taking their stuff, which is very sad. It doesn't really go deeper than that. Like, all of the history is like their legends, and it has nothing to do with like their cultural practices today, except for in, I think it's the third movie, where they all sit around a campfire and talk about how one of their camp elders sacrificed herself. Yeah, it's a whole thing.
No, there's definitely something to be said the way Native Americans are sort of portrayed in Twilight, especially in the way that they're sexualized and, you know, romanticized in a sense. Because if they could just exist the way sort of the Cullen family exists, as intellectual, as kind, as compassionate, like, these are the things Carlisle is ascribed to. These are the things Edward gets to be. Meanwhile, Jacob gets to have his shirt off every single movie, and he gets to be whiny. He gets to be sort of mystical, and he gets to be, you know, sort of indignant about the way they've been treated, which are not bad traits necessarily, but they're very, very much based on Stephenie Meyer's necessity for romance. And so the Native Americans are just used to push the plot of romantic interest, which I get is like the whole point of her book. But I mean, to Sam Francis' point, there's just more to it than that. And if you're going to use him and you're going to use the culture, then use it for something more valuable than motivating love between two white people.
Definitely. And there's also, there is a lot of just like real life weird stuff that happened with her representation of that tribe in the movies, like the Quillette tribe, if that is how you say it. I didn't look that up before I came on here, which was a mistake. But the Quillette tribe is a real Native American tribe with real history and real symbology. And they just took that and used it for like the books and the movies. And there was like a whole tattooing craze around that whole arm thing that Jacob had. And I, to my knowledge, especially at the time when it was all starting, the tribe did not profit from any of that, like, quote unquote, representation that Stephenie Meyer threw their way and that the directors threw at them.
Well, I mean, I think that representation is also highly superficial, right? So like, why would they profit off of it, in the sense that, like, again, it only reinforces stereotypes of what we as Americans believe about certain groups and about our history. And in a way, Twilight actually just reinforces like educational propaganda, which is also why it may be so relatable, right? Like Ambar said, sometimes you see yourself in these characters. And I feel like Twilight, especially when you make teen fiction, actually, and this is true for Harry Potter as well, actually, as you have to think about your target audience. And I think people of color and people who are minorities are generally seen as not the audience for these things because they're kind of left out of the demographic of people who would read teen fiction. And so things that get produced tend to reinforce the majority because the target audience is the majority. And so like nobody else is really profiting off of anything that happens in these books, except for, you know, whoever is in the majority.
Yeah. Going back to your point of Jacob Black serving as
just... Was his last name really Black?
His last name is really Black.
Okay, and I'm cracking up.
There's like so much to unpack in there, right? Because he's literally a scribe, the opposite of, you know, vampire white. Although his fur is like reddish brown, there is a black-furred werewolf in their tribe who is described to have the worst attitude of all of them. So not only are they clearly coded as like people you need to hate, they obviously she's portraying them in a way to make Edward seem like the more likely candidate for Bella's heart. And I also want to say Jacob serves to reinforce stereotypes of just not trusting Native American men because he acts as this like pedophilic father figure to Renesmee, like grooming her to the moment in which she will obviously fall in love with him and therefore it'll be okay for him to have a romantic partner at last.
Well, also that weird story between, I forgot all their names, but I think it's between Seth and like his wife or somebody else. I don't know. I can't remember.
Sam like, and Emily.
Yes.
Where Emily has like literal, like got clawed to the face. And like, you never hear the Cullens having this sort of tragic story in which they can't control themselves as if they're like inherently just like human condition wise superior to the werewolves because they're more aggressive, they're more violent, they're more out of control when they shapeshift. And I'm like, the only time you see it in the Cullens is Jasper, and he's actually given a caveat for that because after he like sort of freaks out seeing blood, he's given like a whole chapter where he's like, I'm changing, I swear, I'm working on it. And he still manages to resist. Whereas the werewolves are not given that sort of explanation. It's just more assumed that they're like this aggressive and more violent type of male or type of group.
We also can't forget that Jasper was a Confederate soldier and that is glossed over. And that should be something that condemns them, but it doesn't.
There's such an absence of ridicule for the Cullen family that I find very suspicious, considering that all of them portray equally horrendous traits to like the werewolf tribes, and yet they continuously get absolved of them, which may have to just do with their whiteness, but I think it also has to do with the fact that they're rich, and rich people tend to get away with everything.
That is absolutely true. And like going back to your point about how like the vampires are never seen as people who lose control, I think they definitely talk about times that they've lost control a lot, but they are afforded the distance of that being part of their past. Like even after all of the times, all of the various times Bella has bled around members of the Cullen family, all of them are just like, let me lose control for a minute. Okay, that's over because that's my past. That's part of my past. That's not who I am anymore. We're vegetarians. And then like around the the werewolves, you can see like this whole difference in like, I'm going to go back to the movies in New Moon. Bella slaps, I think it's Paul in the face. Yeah. Paul has been a vampire. I have to get these mythical creatures right. Paul has been a werewolf for, I think, the second longest of the entire group after Sam, and he still loses it after a tiny little woman slaps him in the face after he insulted her. And it's just a very weird dynamic to have that be like the dangerous other, whereas like Edward, the real dangerous other, has like an admitted weird attraction to Bella's blood where it is almost impossible for him to not drink it.
I think this also comes back to Stephenie Meyer just being Mormon and having this like religious aspect, because the Cullens are frequently described as angels. And so if that's not already like really heavily biblically coded, I don't know what else would be. And the fact that the Quileute tribe can turn into an actual monster, it's just, it's very blatant that one will receive forgiveness because they're tied to Christianity and the other one is very pagan. So it doesn't deserve any reparations or reconciliation.
You know, what I find interesting here is because I can't help thinking about Harry Potter and how we've really discussed Twilight for the last about 20 minutes.
Yes.
But there's something that said that Harry Potter can avoid this sort of criticism. But I think it's because it instills morals in a way that Twilight does not. Like, I think very much Harry Potter is like a fable-esque story where like everything is a moral about rights and wrongs and growing up and whatever, which makes it very much a children's book. But I'm realizing now that although Twilight was published under teen fiction, it is very much anybody's book. An adult could read Twilight, and I know adults who have read Twilight, and they could read it as earnestly as a 17-year-old or as an 11-year-old or whoever, and take something away from it or analyze it in the way that we've been analyzing it. I realize that Harry Potter actually doesn't give itself that much room to be. I mean, it does lend itself to academic analysis, but I don't think Harry Potter lends itself to as much like tween criticism. Because again, it's very hard to subject yourself to criticizing childhood morals than it is to criticizing sort of, well, there's no morals in Twilight, just like a rom-com story.
Like, definitely more rom than com there.
Yeah, I mean, are there morals in Twilight? I feel like there are no values.
It would have to be very Christian morals, right? Because yeah. Edward is propagating this need for like, you know, I get to control Bella, so I get to say when we have sex and things like that. You know, it's like they just feel very typically Christian.
Yeah.
Yeah, the morals are a lot less obvious in Twilight, whereas like in Harry Potter, you do have that big like children's book wrap-up scene at the end of most of the books where like Harry's getting on the train and going home and like one of his adult father figures who leaves him every summer goes like, and remember Harry, love is the most important magic. The end.
You have tears
and then he gets on the train and goes back to his abusive foster parents, and it's a whole thing.
And what saves Harry in the end is amoral, not immoral. But what saves Bella in the end is her making this very adult choice for herself to become a vampire, you know? There's something supposedly less honorable about Bella's slight agency in the end than there is about Harry pursuing something that's as old as time.
Well, I also feel like I just realized how gross the thought of a vampire was in the case of Twilight, actually, just because I'm realizing, like, that Twilight may actually be like a white person's fantasy of immortality, like wanting to produce Christian values forever and ever and ever, which I've only just realized. Maybe I subconsciously knew this and couldn't articulate it. But the sort of Tuck Everlasting turn that this novel is taking, it maybe, again, speaks to its popularity. Like maybe the thought of living forever in the perfect whiteness and youthfulness that you possess in a certain moment must be so appealing. I cannot imagine. I mean, isn't that the whole basis for like white supremacy, right? Like Stephenie Meyer just gave them the manifesto. It's called Twilight.
Wow. That has disturbed me so deeply. And immortality is criticized in Harry Potter. Right? Because Voldemort literally dies from it, a decrepit man, and Bella and Edward get to live unscathed, don't have to worry about predicting the future for any more turmoils or pandemics. They just get away with living.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest difference really is that, isn't it? It's like, at the end of the day, Harry Potter sort of keeps trying to avoid danger in a great way, and like universal danger. I would argue that they're not fighting against like specific group dangers or community issues. They're just saying, like, as a child, these things, and as an adult, these things will scare you and they're bad and you shouldn't do them, you know. And Dumbledore as a figure is so great in a way in that he could choose to be immortal, but obviously is not. And that's the great choice about, you know, YOLO and like life is this one time thing. And Stephanie Meyer really said, no, actually, there's a way we can all live forever. And I think we should do it. And I'm scared.
Yeah, immortality is like this extremely seductive notion in fiction. And it's one that I think now that we've entered the pandemic terrifies me more than any fantasy punishment ever, because immortality is a punishment. To live forever sounds like hell. But it is very appealing to like that younger audience again, where one of their biggest unrealized fears is death. And like younger people are coming to terms with like dying and death every day. So to have this like essential, like Christ-like sparkly man in the forest who can bestow upon you life everlasting is very like, it's very, I don't want to use the word seductive over and over again, but it is very seductive. And that's why a lot of people also relate to like Tuck Everlasting. But it is one of those notions that I think as you read it and reread it, as you get older, it's one of those notions that you grow out of. And like, I don't, this is like, again, the beginning of a thought that I'm having, but I think that there's also a lot to be said about why there are no Black or like people of color vampires, is because immortality is a form of time travel. And people have talked about how like BIPOC do not have the benefit of time traveling in the way that white people do, because time has not been for them. You can't go back to like even the 1990s, the 1970s as a non-white person and have your identity accepted in those same ways. So immortality might not be as alluring for people whose past and whose history has never been concrete, like white history and white power going back ages and ages and ages. There's always a place where you will be able to live as a white person where you are the group in power. You will not be persecuted for your beliefs unless you are a Quaker living in Henry VIII's England, in which case you can get up and leave. And a lot of them did. But yeah, whiteness in like the sense of immortality is very interesting to me. And I don't know where that thought is headed, but I know that if I had time to meditate on it, it would go somewhere else.
No, you're right. And that's why there's such a big need for like Afrofuturistic stories, right? So BIPOC writers, at least in Afrofuturism, can imagine a future in which their Blackness isn't the reason they're not surviving. It's something else. Yeah. I don't have beyond that. I don't know how to apply that to Harry Potter, right? Because immortality is deemed bad regardless of whether you're white or a non-white person. It's what Trisha was saying. It's the post-racial utopia where race isn't the reason someone is being persecuted, unless you're a muggle, and that's different.
Well, I mean, what I'm realizing too is that a lot of the death narratives that happen in Harry Potter and sort of like the knowledge and wisdom that's bestowed on these children comes from people who are adults, like Dumbledore and, you know, Slughorn and Hagrid, and all these people sort of kind of come together and, by the way, teach these kids about death and about life and what that means and how it's very rare to live a very full and good life until the end of it, which sort of not normalizes death, but it gives kids a filter from which to look at sort of what people would consider a tragic thing. And what I'm realizing is that Twilight is actually benefit of adults most of the time, and that their only adult is like the mid 20-year-old Carlisle, who's been existent forever, presumably, who has like a savior complex and just like keeps picking up little orphaned kids and turning them into immortals. And the other option is Charlie, right? Who's like a bumbling dad who doesn't know how to live life, and Bella's like constantly taking care of him. And so there's nobody really in Twilight to instill a sense of real, I guess, ending in a way. So I feel like the story doesn't have as much, not substance, because I think a lot of people would argue that it is substantive for them, but it doesn't hold as many, I don't know where I'm going with this. You know, like the lack of adults, I guess, means like a lack of wisdom sort of in the story, in a way that it doesn't tell kids what's right and what's wrong. It just allow kids to gain power from the fact that they're like presumably no adults in that world.
Yeah. I think that's because if you applied an adult perspective, an adult lens to Twilight, someone would have been like, this is abusive behavior. And maybe we should talk about it. Whereas like in Harry Potter, the adult perspective is very valued because like all of their child worries are put into the perspective of larger adult worries. And like, I feel like I feel like Harry Potter is very validating for children because of that adult perspective. Like, even if you don't have that adult voice in your life, all of the adult voices in Harry Potter, or at least the good ones, look at the children and say, yeah, you're right to be worried about this because this is a concerning situation. Whereas in Twilight, the adult perspective would quite literally tear apart the narrative if it were given the chance to.
Yeah, I mean, I think Twilight just kind of relies on the idea that teens and children and, you know, are like adults and that they can figure things out on their own, which I guess is a great thing to read when you feel like you don't really have a lot of control and you're reading something where all these teens are just figuring shit out by themselves. And you're like, yeah, I can just go to Italy and chase my lover. Like, I could do that too. I'm making choices. But I think what people sometimes forget when they're reading is that the choices of characters are often dictated by an author. And so like these choices are not really autonomous in any really great way. And they're not necessarily independent either. And both series really relies on a sustained fandom. Like if you think about the kind of crazy fandom that popped out of from these series, you have to think about what about these stories is like making that happen. And what's like the longevity of these things, right? Like we're still talking about it in 2020. I think Stephanie Meyer's coming out with like a whole new story.
Oh, yeah.
And it's everyone cares so much. And there has to be something to be said about the freedom, at least in Twilight, in which these teenagers like possess, that they can do whatever they want, whenever they want. Which I think is, it could be said for Harry Potter, just that what Sam said is that in Harry Potter, at least you have adults who are kind of the framework for any choices being made. Whereas Twilight, it's sort of like fully free.
I think that's also what's really interesting if we're looking at the Twilight films versus the books, because in the books, it's incredibly more obvious that there's no adult presence. And even if there were, it just confirms that, you know, being a youthful teenager for the rest of your life is the only way you'll have a fulfilling life. But in the movies, Carlisle's like a 40-year-old man. There are so many adults. And so I think you can argue the values are more obvious in the films, and that might have to do with casting, but I also suspect it has to do with Stephanie Meyer and her Mormon influence and not trying to show adults in a poor light.
Can we also just talk about, I mean, Harry Potter is sort of, like I said, it kind of avoids this, so I guess it would leave us on Twilight, but just the gender issues that I'm having with Twilight, with the binaries that occur and the sort of romantic tropes that it has defined, arguably, for like the generation, I would argue the 10 years afterward, people still think that some part of it is really romantic. Although I would argue now a lot of people are like, okay, that it's creepy and weird. But at the time, Edward and Bella were like your Romeo and Juliet-esque story. And I find it incredibly problematic, right? Like, obviously, we're talking about the issue. Like, Myers clearly puts out a lot of problematic things. But the fact that this, like, sort of romantic trope has stuck around, I find very concerning.
So which aspects do you want to tackle first, right? Do you want to tackle sleeping, watching someone sleep in their room? Do you want to tackle the dishonesty, the stalking, codependency?
I feel like for me, I actually really have an issue with Bella more so than I do with Edward, because Edward, in a way, portrays the most prototypically masculine, patriarchal, like, dude. But I'm not really sure where Bella fits, because in moments I feel like Myers gives her autonomy, but then other moments she's like 1950s docility, like everything is deferred to Edward. But there are moments where Edward also shows a sense of like masculine like concern for her in a way that's like, I want to protect you from me. And she refuses to sort of follow up on that just based on this sort of like girlish whim.
Could it be that where this might be a weird place to take, because I do agree that Bella is a very problematic young woman, but could it be possible that we're just victim blaming her? We have more of a problem with her than we do with Edward?
It's not necessarily that I have more of a problem, but I think a lot of the time Edward gets like all of the flack, right, for all the things you listed, because they're like, oh, he watches her in his sleep and he's stalking her and he's whatever. And I'm like, okay, but like he also was like, I'm weird and I'm gonna do that. And she was like, but I love you. Like, I think there's something to be said about her weird subservience in the situation till that point. I mean, even from the first point, if you think about the movies, right? Like the first time they see each other, he literally like gags, he dies. And she continues to be obsessed with him. And I think that's such a sickening thought, is that are all young girls supposed to like want not being wanted? It seems like what she's speaking to is this teenage self-hatred, and she's saying, no, it's valid and you should actually like feed into it. You should be self-hating enough to respond with love to rejection.
That is deep. That is a deep thought.
I feel like throwing up.
Bella definitely does not, she is not like in the sense that this is an abusive relationship, at least in the first book. She is not the quote unquote like ideal victim in any sense of the word. Like she, I don't know. I feel like she was the, not the original character, but the original young adult character who perpetuated the idea that like all men who are mean to you are just little boxes that are wrapped that you need to like pull the string on. And if you are kind enough to them and understanding enough to them, then they will open up like a flower in sunlight and they will share with you all of their super broody secrets and then you can fix them. And that, while it was super helpful for plot development, is not a great notion to carry through your life. But what I will say about their relationship in Twilight is, like, as a survivor of an abusive relationship myself, I find it very, very difficult to watch the first movie because it is deeply, deeply triggering. 'Cause, like, all of those things that like Edward does where he's just like, I'm dangerous, stay away. I don't want you near me, stay away from me. All of those are like abuser tactics where he employs those in moments where he knows that she'll be like, no, Edward, I love you and I accept you, because he knows his behavior is unacceptable. And he knows that if he continues to display this behavior unchecked, he will lose her. So he checks himself in that way where he's just like, I am a danger to you. And he gets her to self-doubt her own impulse of danger by saying verbally to him, no, I am not in danger. And he says, I am a danger to you. And she says, no, you are not a danger to me. And that cycle repeats and repeats until all of a sudden he hurts her physically or in some other way. And she has no problem with it because she has verbally and mentally been denying that he is a danger to her this whole time. So to admit that he is a danger to her is not only to admit to her 17-year-old self, because she is 17, that she was wrong about him, but also that she has put herself in this danger by denying it. And that's that on that.
No, it's absolutely true. And I mean, if you really think about it, right, like the red flags Sam just mentioned are all over the place. But I mean, it really culminates in Edward actually doing the whole, I'm going to kill myself because Bella, whatever. And he literally goes to the Volturi and he's like, gonna do it, gonna kill myself, which forces her to go save him, which some people think is like incredibly like, you know, strong of her, and like she went off on her own to go save her dude, and it's like a reversal of the genders. And I'm like, oh no, no, no. It's him saying, you know, if we put this in a modern day context, it's literally Edward being like, if you break up with me, I'm gonna slit my wrists. And she goes all the way to Italy, like really upending her entire life, right? Like this is a 17-year-old girl who clearly has like work and ambitions and things to do, and yet she goes all this way and makes herself known to these really dangerous, horrible people in the effort to like almost be subjected. It's like even when she has freedom from him, the manipulation is so strong that to her, subjugation is actually the real freedom, or feels like freedom, if that makes sense.
I think we also have to talk about how Edward's abuse is made appealing in comparison to what Jacob propagates, right? Because Jacob, I mean, I don't remember much of his. I do remember there was like a non-consensual kiss, and he's very pushy, but he's also honest, you know? Like at least he doesn't pretend that Bella is not capable of taking care of herself. He actually helps her through the period of her depression, admittedly, and that's not to give him props. It's just being a decent human being. But there's something almost vaguely disgusting about the way how honest he is in like treating her with, you know, autonomy and respect, and also just being very forthcoming about his feelings. It's like, why be with, you know, someone who actually cares about you when you can push harder for something more passionate?
Jacob is the ultimate simp. He simps for Bella for years, and then he commits to simping for her child, which is worse, much worse.
Oy. Yeah, women in this novel and this movie franchise seem to always be belonging to some male figure. I mean, it's just imprinting is like literally the most physical form of like territorializing women. But I mean, Edward does it, Jacob does it. Although arguably, Ambar, you're right. Because in the way Bella is described without Edward is reckless. Like without Edward, Bella clearly, like apparently can't control her emotions. She becomes an adrenaline junkie. Like she's just all over the place. She's like, I need Edward to like keep me chill. Yeah, yeah, Taming of the Shrew, literally. And like, you know, this same cannot be, and yet that's portrayed in almost like a romantic light, that like without the person you love, you do crazy things, versus like Jacob was clearly there the whole time, and that's just sort of portrayed as like stupid on his part because he's so soft and like she clearly doesn't care because she's not doing crazy things when he's gone. And I'm like, so we actually demonize supporting people and caring for them and being there when you need them to be there. But we love to romanticize reckless behavior, abusive relationships, and manipulation.
I guess it's fair of Stephanie Meyer to balance the scales of abuse on both sides from the men. One just happens the entire time, the other one waits until Bella is pregnant.
Yeah, and they're they're both very different, like, in their tactics, but ultimately both of them are extremely controlling of Bella, and both of them are very much of that mindset where, like, we know better than you do for choices that you are making about your own body and your own autonomy. And you see that with Jacob, like, his, like, whole Eliza Hamilton moment of, like, I'm erasing myself from the narrative. Goodbye forever, Bella. And she's like, no, we're friends, and you got me through a period where someone else erased himself from the narrative. So could you please explain to me why you're emotionally ghosting me at this time period? And he's like, it's because, and he uses that, like, famous Edward line, it's because I'm dangerous, Bella. It's because I'm not good for you. And when she demands to know why, like, when she comes after him and demands that closure, she is again demonized for, like, that whole, like, why can't you accept this? It's a whole thing.
And not to say these levels of abuse are the same in Harry Potter, because there's no love triangle, but we do see this abuse of love with Dumbledore, but because it's from an adult and because, again, it's portrayed in this, like, really loving manner, it's okay.
Yeah. But I mean, there's also something to be said about the abuse in Harry Potter almost being more realistic, per se. At least for children, right? Like, I'm not sure that every child could relate or even recognize maybe the latent abuse that's in Twilight. That you can, because it's not between adults, it's between people of the same age. But I think a lot of kids and teens often feel abuse from adults in whatever way that is. And most of the time it is a sort of abuse of love that kids feel from whatever the adult figure it is in their life. Which makes Harry Potter, again, so endearing and nostalgic in a way, is because you can recognize that sort of manipulation, but it feels almost familial in the way that Twilight doesn't, because I don't think a lot of kids and teens are comfortable addressing or confronting the abuse they have between peers or between like-minded or like-aged people, which is why Twilight in the adult lens becomes so extremely problematic. Yet it has managed to define arguably like social structures for over like a decade, you know, whether people want to admit it or not. I think Twilight and Harry Potter and the likes have sort of become foundational for teens and kids. But what they're reproducing, the more we talk about it, is very scary. It's a very scary level of a warped idea of what it means to be a certain age.
And there's like, in Harry Potter, all of the like adult to child dynamics have some sort of, like, all of those abusive dynamics get some sort of little button up at the end where, and this is something that children are probably very unlikely to get in real life, where the adults in the life of the children have a little moment where they like come to themselves and they go, I was wrong to do this to you. Like, I think is it the fourth book or the fifth book where Dumbledore has this like pull away moment from Harry, and he's just like, I can't be near you because I'm dealing with my adult thing over here. And Harry's like, but I have important business to discuss with you, Dumbledore. And he goes, not now. And then at the end of that book, he goes like, you know what? It was extremely bad of me for me to do this to you, and I'm very sorry that I emotionally withdrew from you. And that apology just like is not something that children are ever realistically likely to get from adults. Mm-hmm. And then like even at the like spoiler alerts coming your way at the very end of the series, all the way at the end with Petunia Dursley, where like their whole family has to move because Voldemort knows where they are, Petunia Dursley comes to her like nephew who she has been horrible to her whole life, and her son comes to him and he's been horrible to Harry their whole life, and he says like, I'm really really sorry that I did this to you. I didn't know what was going on in your life, and you remind me of my dead sister, which was very hard on me personally, and I get that you're 17 now, go do your thing.
Yeah, I mean, it also, there's something to be said about the fact that Harry also has to do something exceptional to continuously get these apologies. Like, he doesn't receive them until he, like, I guess, performs beyond their expectations. And also, he receives that apology from Dumbledore upon the death of his, like, only real relative. And I think Dumbledore doesn't necessarily feel bad about emotionally pulling away. He just feels bad that Harry has now suffered a trauma that's like, it can't go unnoticed. Because I think Dumbledore is very comfortable letting him suffer the trauma of living at Fort Pervert Drive forever. But somehow the loss of Sirius Black becomes the more noticeable trauma that, like, Dumbledore really can't get over. Like, he won't get away with it without apologizing for it. And, like, until Harry becomes sort of this, like, royal king of the Muggle world and it's starting to affect the Dursleys, it is only up until that point that they apologize, where they're like, okay, now he's something of substance that we have to apologize for or to. Which I guess is a point in favor of Twilight in a way, because at least nobody apologizes for themselves in that story. They just all are, you know, sans fault, I guess.
At least they're all unrepentant dicks.
Yeah, like, they're all not remorseful and they have no faults or flaws. It's like the most utopic vision of white America I've ever seen. It's incredible.
I think that's where Twilight TikTok comes in. Sam, do you follow on that? Twilight TikTok? Oh yeah, the Renaissance has come up in which all of these issues are talked about and made fun of. There's a trend in which college students pretend they're the latest member of the Cullen family, and they engage in, like, therapy sessions with each Cullen family member, holding them accountable against their, like, utopic vision of that ending. So it's a small community, but it's being done.
There's also this one girl who, like, she goes through, like, what would happen if Bella was a real normal teenager interacting with Edward, and she, like, she acts out Bella's inner monologue where Edward, like, gags when he sees her, and she goes, like, oh shit, do I smell? I forgot deodorant. Oh my god. Oh my god, I forgot deodorant. How am I gonna get through gym class? And that popped off and went viral for a minute.
I just wonder if I'm ever gonna live a life in which Twilight doesn't, like, fucking take up my time anymore. You know what I mean? Like, it's just socially ingrained.
Yeah.
Enough that people might keep talking about it well into my 20s and 30s, and I pray that I can get away from the horrific legacy of that story someday.
I think some people try to take Team Bella seriously, but it's really hard to take Team Bella seriously when she doesn't even take Team Bella seriously.
I'm Team Butt Crack Santa.
Of course you bring that up.
What?
Sam, do you not know Buttcrack Santa?
I do not. Who is
Waylon,
he?
Waylon Forge in the first movie, the weird guy who's like, hey, Bella, remember in fourth grade you came over?
Dude, I'm...
Oh, that strange man.
They mentioned Buttcrack Santa, like, once as a joke.
Buttcrack Santa. No, yo, he got a whole scene where he gets eaten on his boat. He's wearing a Kiss Me, I'm Irish t-shirt. He's singing.
He's vaguely predatory toward Victoria when she came on the boat. Like, he was like, oh, sexually appealing woman? Let me stop singing and just look at her up and down.
And then she ate him alive.
That's feminism.
I'm Bar. You're Butt Crack Santa.
She thinks I am Waylon Forge in the films.
Umbar has the, hi, I'm this person, remember me, at the diner vibe.
I think that I'm more Alice Cullen than anything.
You're projecting. No shot.
I am very uncomfortable with the environment that we've created in the studio.
This is now an unsafe space for anybody that's not me.
We all did want to be Alice Cullen at some point. Like, I don't know if you were this kid, but I was in elementary school, middle school, definitely this kid who would, like, look out the window and pretend to see something and be like, and someone be like, are you okay? And I'd be like, it's nothing, It's nothing.
Dude, I watched Twilight. I got a paper cut and I sucked on it, and this boy in fourth grade called me out, and I was like, I just like the taste.
Ew.
Brandon Montalvo, if you're listening, I was dumb.
You said, I like the taste of blood. That's funny.
Which no, really I feel funny, like I still Bella hated it.
This is what I mean about the legacy of Twilight. I still sometimes pull that shit where, like, I'll see a cute dude, but I'll pretend to be really mysterious, quote unquote, and like look off into the distance. And like most people will just be like, what the fuck are you looking at? And I'm just like, the distance, bitch.
She said, Manic Pixie Dream Girl.
I actually said a mixture of Manic Pixie Dream Girl and Sad Girl.
That is Bella Swan.
Yeah, it's the combo. The combo you crave.
At least what I appreciate from the first film is how ridiculously funny it is. And it doesn't recognize that it is funny, but it is.
Dude, Rob Pattinson deserved better. It is the worst acted movie I've literally ever seen, period. And he is better than it.
I think the first movie definitely took itself less seriously than the movies after it did. Like, there was that whole thing about, like Bella and Mike, like, should we go see Love Equals, like, Love spelled backward is love, and she's just like, no, we have to go see Face Punch, the action movie of our generation. Face Punch. And now that I'm thinking about this, that might have been the second movie, but
also all of Bella's friends, I just think it's so funny that Bella was like described as the standalone, like, mysterious hottie, and all her friends are like tweens and they're dumb and stupid, and like Bella's the cool one.
And I'm the cool mysterious one.
Yeah, I said I love to tear down other people to make myself look better. Great job.
You remember when Angela was looking for like news features in the first movie, and then Bella was like, I mean, you could just write about like eating disorders. Angela and Jessica were like, wow, that's like so progressive.
That's a great idea. Yeah. That's the equivalent of the Camp Rock scene where like Allison Stoner's like tapping on the keyboard.
It's my favorite scene.
She's really good.
Dude, it's such a good scene. But Demi Lovato does that, by the way, in the Camp Rock movies before that Allison Stoner scene when she gets there, that guy's like drumming on a bus. And she's freaking out. I was like, no, he's not drumming on that fucking bus.
That entire movie was just theater kids and diners. Like, dude. But it was.
I think the conclusion for this episode is that you should always look through a socially aware lens when reading your books. And that self-awareness is also incredibly cringeworthy.
Yeah, I mean, if you're young, don't be too hard on yourselves if you've read these things or if you want to continue to read them. Obviously, there's nothing wrong with that, but like, obviously, like, just continue to keep in mind that they're problematic in whatever way that they are, and then, you know, enjoy it.
Yeah, also, just continue to be critical of your media, because there's nothing wrong with loving the things you love. There's nothing wrong with loving Harry Potter, even though J.K. Rowling is a rampant transphobe now, which who saw that coming?
She's just such a great wompund.
But yeah, continue to be critical of your media and what you consume, because as long as you're thinking about it critically, you can stand the Edward Bella relationship if that is your choice.
All right, guys.
His icicle dick.
disgusting. I hope Laura cuts that out.
Laura, you can keep it. Bye.
All right, guys. Thanks for listening. Big shout out to Kieran Choi and his brother Connor Choi. Check them out. You can find them on YouTube. You can also find them on Facebook and Instagram. And also,
big thank you to our sound designer, Laura Feliz. She is a recent graduate of TCNJ's graphic design program. Check out her Instagram for more information.
Women of Dolor aims to alienate no one and address everyone in discussing topics of culture, society, and humanity in a way that bridges gaps of understanding and illuminates misinformation.